21st Century HR is a podcast exploring how to build better businesses through modern people practices and approaches. It's brought to you by my firm, Amplify. Amplify provides HR executive search and strategic consulting services that help companies build better organizations. From employer brand development and execution to global talent strategies, Amplify develops custom solutions that help clients from Hootsuite to SpaceX optimize their recruiting capabilities. Amplify also hosts a new community for HR leaders called the Ecosystem. The Ecosystem was designed to bring modern HR leaders around the world together to share ideas, inspiration, and support. Learn more at amplifytalent.com. Hey, what's up, everyone? Welcome to 21st Century HR Live. I'm your host, Lars Schmidt. And we are back today with a guest coming to us live from the Cayman Islands. So as many of us are sheltering in place, there are probably not too many worse places than you could shelter in the Cayman Islands. So we're going to learn about what it is like to be quarantining in the Caribbean, and also getting into Chris Bailey's role at PwC, getting into his career, what he's seeing, how the island is responding to COVID, as well as his training routines. He is a triathlete. He's been training in a variety of areas, and obviously that's a little impacted right now. So maybe we're going to get some quarantine training tips from Chris. So with that, I just want to do a quick reminder, if you're new to the show, these broadcasts are intended to be interactive. So if you have questions for Chris during the broadcast, wherever you're streaming this, just ask your question in the streaming platform, and I'll do my best to cover those with him on air. So with that, let's go ahead and bring Chris on.
Hey.
Chris, how are you, man? Good to have you on.
Good morning. It's good to be here, although I'm pretty sure most of your viewers have just decided to log off when they heard they're going to be a guy from the Caribbean sat on a camera going, hey, look how great it is here.
No, I think that's not true.
Everyone wants to hear that.
You're recording from a rooftop or something so they can see the, beautiful blue ocean behind you. So I'll be honest, it's a little disappointing that we've got a room behind you. I think you've got to work on that setup.
I'm gonna have to actually. But it's one of those, if I did that, all the light would just, I'd be dark. And so you wouldn't see me. So I'm always impressed because your background's got really cool skateboards and that sort of thing. Your guy, yes, they had guitars and like cool looking music. Yeah. And I got a room.
Yeah, I guess if you're doing these things every day, you've got to have a setup here. So Will Staney's studio, I think, might win. He's got guitars and drums and everything there. So Chris, for viewers that aren't familiar with you, before we dig into the conversation, I'd love for you to start with just an introduction and a background. You've done a lot of stuff. You've worked in a lot of places. So I'd love to just give an overview of that just to help introduce yourself to viewers.
Sure, no problem at all. So my name's Chris Bailey. I started my career in the UK, if you can't guess by the weird accent that's been messed up by traveling around for the last few years. And I started out life as a recruiter. I was a recruiter for a well-known recruitment company in the UK and built offices, built teams, and spent a lot of time in that market. And funny enough, I always wanted to get out and travel a little bit. I wanted to do something a little bit different. And I was just, this was almost at the time my internet was still just getting going. And I managed to see a job called Rainmaker on a website, an international recruitment website. And it was for a job in Bermuda, of all places. And I was like, Bermuda sounds cool. We should go to Bermuda. And I turned to my wife and I said, listen, do you fancy going to Bermuda? I said, there's a job here and I reckon I could do it and I should apply for it. And she went, yeah, where's Bermuda? And so I was like, it's Caribbean. Surely it's in the Caribbean. It's not. It's in the middle of the Atlantic, about 800 miles off the coast of North Carolina. It's definitely not in the Caribbean, but it's a beautiful island. But I was, as wives do, they kind of just say, yeah, sure, you apply for that. And I'm sure you'll get it. I'm sure we're moving to Bermuda. 4 weeks later, we moved to Bermuda, and that was the start of probably the eye-opening phase of getting involved with international HR, getting involved in sort of international business development, and seeing the whole plethora of candidates from all over the world, not just from a microcosm of the area I was based in the UK. And what was interesting was, at the time in Bermuda, this was just post-Katrina, and so companies and reinsurance companies were hiring like crazy. And so our company had around 50 or so kind of HR, senior HR folk placed at the reinsurance companies. And I was helping to manage those contracts, those relationships, and I was hearing all the problems that HR folk have, everything from HRAS to how to build their teams, to employee engagement issues, to ER issues in terms of how frustrated they would get with people just not doing what they need to do. And so hearing all this just got me really interested in how I could actually help from a almost like a non-HR, HR standpoint. And with a business development hat on to look at how actually some of these people issues could help the businesses themselves. And so fast forward a few years, I ended up getting the HR calls just because I felt it gave me a little bit of a foundation to stand on when I was trying to advise people. And the role steamrolled into me coming to the Cayman Islands. And I've been in Cayman now nearly 9 years. I can tell you it's flown. But during those 9 years in Cayman, I got to work for PricewaterhouseCoopers, where I'm currently at now, and I lead their people and organization advisory consulting practice. So we go into companies now proactively and help them with their people issues. And that can be anything from wanting a comp philosophy to we've got to merge 5,000 employees with this new company's other 5,000 employees, and how do we bring them all together and make it work. So it's got me involved in some really wonderful and interesting pieces of work that I'd never have had the opportunity to do if I'd stayed at home in the UK and not put myself out there. And that's also led now to I run the largest HR conference in the Caribbean, which has got how I got introduced to kind of you, Lars, and other people on the sort of the HR speaking circuit, and a big involvement with things like WorkHuman and other stuff like that. So it's kind of seen me bridge the divide between the Caribbean and the US. And so there's always a lot of folks that want to come down to the Cayman Islands, naturally. And there's a lot of reasons why a lot of our companies that are down here are also US companies. So there's an awful lot of sort of flow between the two worlds. But that is probably the whistle stop, 3 minute who I is. And coming to an island like Grand Cayman, everybody's got their top off because it's an island and it's a beach. And I was a fat 30 something guy, late 30s, and realized that, look, you know, I couldn't get in shape the way I used to in your sort of early 20s, where everyone seems to be able to eat everything and still have a six pack. So in order to make myself feel better as my mental health and just I liked the focus, I got started running and swimming and cycling and then Ironman and all that good stuff, just to try and keep up with the all the young people we employ who come on looking fantastic, and it gave me real body issues. So I'm a big advocate for wellness in general, both mental and physical, and how that kind of really does help engagement and sort of your own well-being. And wellness is a huge topic, as you well know. So that's me, the whistle stop. Here I is.
Yeah, well, there's a lot to explore there, way more than we'll have the opportunity to with the time we have. But I want to, you know, from a work perspective, you know, obviously you're in a role with PwC, you're advising companies in the area on a host of topics around people issues, talent issues, projects. How are you seeing kind of COVID impact that? Or I guess I shouldn't say how. You know, are you seeing that begin to shift and shape the client needs and the requests that are coming to you? And if so, how?
Wow, that's a big question. Let's take a step back and just give people an idea of how we're affected in Cayman and how that's affecting business here. So our government was very proactive. And the way our government is, we have a sort of premier, a prime minister of sorts, and we have a governor. And the governor is the Queen's representative in the Cayman Islands. So we're a British colony. I can't say that. Colony. We're a British colony that is self-governing, but we have a governor from the UK who is based here to make sure that we're following all the right rules and procedures. And because we're an island, we have a population of around 50 or 60,000 people. And we obviously that population can double most days when we bring cruise ships in. And a lot, so we have kind of two or three pillars of society. We're the sixth largest financial center in the world. So lots of the major banks and law firms and are based here within the financial service sector. And then we have a huge tourism sector. Pretty much every major hotel, your Ritz-Carlton's, your Westin's, your Marriott's, they're all along this stretch called 7 Mile Beach, and they cater for overnight tourists. And the cruise ships bring in the day tourists, and then there's a plethora of tourism associated activities. Diving is phenomenal here. And when the talk of COVID first started coming out in kind of early March, our government was very, very quick and very proactive to kind of act, and were initially immediately stopped the cruise ships coming in. Now that's a really tough stance to take, because that's, you know, 20,000 people a day coming in and bringing revenue into the island. But they took the immediate stance of, look, we just can't take the risk, don't know where this is going. And then unfortunately, there was offshore, somebody was having a medical emergency on board one of the cruise ships. It was an Italian gentleman, and he was airlifted to Grand Cayman to be treated. But it was a cardiac issue that he was suffering. And unfortunately, it was so early on in the times of COVID that we didn't realize that he was infected. And so when he got to Grand Cayman, he infected the doctors and nurses that were treating him for his cardiac issue, which immediately meant that we had to lock down one of our hospitals here, which immediately meant that we had to contain spread, we had to contain everything. So the government at that point locked everything down. So they shut the borders, they put everybody under stay at home curfew. And what I mean by that is you weren't allowed out of your house overnight at all for any reason. It was a hard curfew. And you could only go to the supermarkets on a certain day that is your letter day, basically. So if you appeared in a certain part of the alphabet, that was your day to go to the supermarket, again, to limit the amount of people. And the really sound reasoning and rationale for this is that Cayman probably only has, and I'm guessing here, around 200 or 300 hospital beds. We only had 43 ventilators. So if this spread was to take hold in our population, it wouldn't be good for us. So the government just did an amazing job of saying, look, the economy will come back. We need people here alive in order to make the economy come back. If we allow this thing to spread and, you know, we have deaths on the island, it's not good for Cayman. So they shut it down, and I applaud them for taking that early decisive action, because we've had 73 cases. And the only death that we've had is the original Italian gentleman that was airlifted through cardiac issues, who caused the initial outbreak. We've now managed to have Little Cayman, one of our sister islands, that is now COVID-free. I think it won't be long before Cayman Brac is declared COVID-free, and I think it won't be long shortly after the Cayman's cases. We're testing hundreds of people a day, and the results are coming back. Mainly negative. You know, we're talking one or two cases, but they're contained to either frontline workers or people actually connected with dealing with patients that already have the disease. So they've been so proactive, that's been fantastic. And I think we'll generally see it, but we actually can't open our borders until the US kind of figures out what it is there, how they're dealing with it, because we can't import it back in. So Cayman will remain shut to tourism, which creates a huge problem, because we have loads of major hotels that are currently closed. We have lots of people unemployed that worked in the tourism sector. And when I say lots of people, you're probably talking, maybe losing 10 to 15,000 jobs that are either at the moment on hold or will be lost if this continues in Cayman. And so that's a very hard reality to face going forward. What has been very nice to see is that the financial services community, the government, are looking at so many areas to how to readdress, redeploy, retrain displaced workers. And it isn't a quick solution. And one of the frustrations is everyone's going, what do we do? What do we do? What do we do? I'm like, at the moment, we formulate a longer term plan here, because I don't know if you've ever seen William Bridges, it's the phases of a change. And every one of us has already been through this change. And I'll give you a really good example of this change. So many companies were like, we don't like remote working. We like to see people in the offices. They're not moving anywhere. They're going to stay in the office. And no, we're not doing remote working. Well, Thanos snapped his fingers and the world changed in an instant. And suddenly everybody is remote working. So we've seen people go through this first phase of denial, shock, resistance, anger, frustration, bargaining, fear of loss, and this uncertainty. And now they're in the bottom of this curve that William Bridges kind of outlined as this, and it's confusion and undirected energy, a little bit of productivity dipping. But the nice thing is in that bottom part of this phase is you see creativity, you see innovation, and then comes with it this acceptance, this hopefulness, this experimentation and commitment to what's going to be the new thing. And we've all done that with remote working. Shock, fear, oh my God, what's happening? Oh, a little bit unproductive, trying to figure out Zoom and the many people of Zoom and all those sort of things. And now we're into this, this is the new normal. We're working from home. I'm doing a broadcast with you from home. My meetings are pretty much all over VC at the moment. And I'm dealing with different people issues. We're dealing with a lot more mental health. We're dealing with a lot more engagement. We're dealing with a lot more thing. But productivity seems to be remaining. For the businesses that are open and working in this way, productivity is still pretty good. I mean, from a PwC perspective, you know, we completed all of our on-island assurance work, our advisor work is busy, and people are, you know, meeting deadlines, no problem at all. And yet they're doing it from the comfort of their own home, which 6 weeks ago was a little still very much like, really, we're going to do this from home? So the challenges and problems that we face over the next 6 months are very different, but we're going to go through this same cycle of initial denial, that can't possibly work, that's not going to work, to this. And I think everybody right now is in this neutral phase, no matter kind of what business you're in. It's kind of, we're just uncertain how it comes. Is there going to be a second wave? How's that going to affect us? And there was a lady who spoke on another platform yesterday, Jane Watson was the name, and she made a comment that really resonated with me, and she called it pandemic innovation. And I was like, oh, okay, where's this going to go? Pandemic innovation. And she spoke about it as to be an anthropologist, which meant taking a step back and observing nature, what anthropologists do. And it was one of those things where it was like, listen, let's just slow down a little bit and listen to what our people in our organizations are telling us. Let's listen to the information that we're being received, and let's sort of notice what's working and what isn't, and not make huge company-wide change initiatives. Let's just cultivate the stuff that's working, kind of not necessarily ignore the stuff that isn't, but just understand why it isn't working, but focus on the stuff that is really working. And so she also then, as part of being this anthropologist, she wanted to look at positive deviance or positive deviation. And that was looking more at this, what's working. And it was also talking to teens specifically about how they've managed to figure certain stuff out and make that work as well. So I really liked that kind of step back approach. And I often say this when clients come to us and go, we've got this problem, we just don't know how to fix it because we don't know what's coming next. I'm like, okay, let's work with what we've got now. Let's work with what is working in the organization. Let's focus on these positives. And then, okay, are these business critical issues that are going to affect either your bottom line or your people? Normally people first, bottom line second. If you think about it that way, it will tend to play itself out very nicely. And then we look at how we make very small changes, and actually we call it experiments. Let's start with this as an experiment, and if this works and this takes hold, then we can roll it out to the next phase and the next phase and make it bigger and bigger and bigger if that's the way it goes. Or it didn't work, but we only lost a little bit amount of time and we only affected a very small team or populace, but let's now experiment this way and see if this piece works. So a lot of the time it's really about just winding itself back a little bit, having that kind of ability to just stop and listen. And I'll take that as my cue to stop and listen to the next question. Or even instead of I answered that way, I went way off on there.
No, you packed in a couple answers there, so it was good to kind of get your take, especially on just like what you're seeing. And I think you raised some really interesting points, particularly when you talk about the, you know, Thanos snapping his fingers and now we're all remote. In the last 2 weeks, I've had three conversations with CEOs whose organizations shifted to remote. And all of them were, prior to March, anti-remote. And when I pressed them on it, you know, each of them said they were anti-remote because they sucked at remote. they weren't able to find a way to be productive when working remote. So they assumed that nobody else could. Right. And I think that that happens a lot with CEOs and leadership roles. And now, obviously, they've, you know, they've shifted to this, whatever initial kinks had to work out, they've worked out, you know, and now they're humming and they're all coming back. Like, look, actually, now that I've, you know, this was a force kind of issue when you're, you know, obviously you didn't have a choice. You had to move to this position and you had to adapt, and they have adapted. And so now they've changed their thinking around, you know, the ability for people to do that. And so I think it's absolutely a turning point for remote work. You know, eventually some people will go back into office. Some people will want to go back into office. Some people will never go back in the office.
And that could be the new normal, right? I mean, we have huge real estate of offices right now that cost companies tens of thousands of dollars in rent and that per month. There's always been a movement within PwC that, look, we want to be on client sites, want to be front facing. Let's hotel. Let's not give everybody an office. But there's still there's big spaces that we occupy. And we did what was really interesting. PwC did its 23rd survey of around 1,500 plus businesses and CEOs specifically. Yeah. And we released this report literally just before COVID took hold. So we had all these CEO responses around how they think about talent, how they think about key skills. And 74% of them were concerned about the availability of key skills. So PwC have continued to release this report, even though COVID happened literally the day after the report was released, because we actually believe that none of the things that the CEOs were concerned about have changed. If anything, they've gone up. So this brings you into this upskilling kind of environment then, in terms of what are the, and so a lot of what we're talking about is automation. So it's actually almost accelerated the automation conversation, which everyone was kind of sick of hearing because AI was going to take over the world. But a bit like that mustache of yours, I've just noticed. If your viewers haven't noticed his mustache, it's a proper good mustache.
I mean, I don't know if the viewers could not. It's there. It's introducing itself.
It is. It's a bit like AI. It's kind of crept up on you, and suddenly it's taken over. And that's
exactly what we've seen. The universe.
But that's what we've seen, right? We've seen them be totally against remote working to 100% everyone's remote working. And now you're going to see, okay, we were concerned about the availability of key skills, but we've got to have them technically enabled to be able to take advantage of emerging tech, right? And I think where there was resistance to invest in tech and automate procedures because of the whole pushback of, will this affect people's jobs, will this reduce number of people, I think you're going to see that actually accelerate at an incredible rate. So a lot of the HR tech companies that were kind of waiting for their platform to explode, I think, you know, once companies know what they've got in terms of coffers left at the end of this, that's where the investment's going to be. The transferable skills that organizations need today, creativity, problem solving, understanding how digital tech can be used, those that help people think and act and thrive in a digital world, those are the key skills now that I would be looking at across my organization going, okay, how do I ensure that my employees can get and adapt or improve those key things? And when you were looking for things like creativity, how do you manage that? How do you manage it? How do you actually calculate how innovative somebody can be or how dynamic they can be? Well, the easiest way to do that is look back at the situation and look who just went, yep, fine, remote working, dashed it. Those are the people you're going to want around you going forward. And if you're one of the people that was like, ooh, panic, then you know that you're going to have to be a lot more dynamic going forward and work on that yourself.
Well, when you think about the, you know, the feedback from the CEOs in the report you ran, you know, talent shortages, and the concerns about the ability to find talent.
Yep.
Look at remote, right? When you have an environment that is distributed to remote, even if it's not 100% distributed, you can find talent anywhere, right? And especially if you're a company in a really expensive city like San Francisco or London, Stockholm, et cetera. Yeah. You don't have to just look for talent in your backyard. You can go global, your search for talent. And again, like there's going to be a lot of people who will never go back into an office, from this shift, more than a here or there number, like it's going to be measurable. And so how are companies going to account for that? How are they actually going to adapt and adjust their practices? And I think it's interesting. You mentioned real estate. I wouldn't want to be working in commercial real estate right now. I wouldn't want to be sitting with a lot of actually, okay, I take that back. I wouldn't mind having got buildings. That'd be great. But the idea that, you know, companies now, they've been remote for months. And, you know, now in the US, we're starting to talk about return to work. We're starting to talk about those plans. Some states are beginning to end some of their shelter in place protocols. Whether that's smart or not, we'll see. But there is pressure to start getting people back in an office. And I think it's going to be interesting when companies are evaluating, like you're spending tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars in commercial real estate. And now you're only going to be able to fit 40% of the headcount that you used to have in that building in order to maintain social distancing. You're going to have to put partitions, you know, and you're going to go to cubes or some sort of divided area workspaces where employees are at work together. I think in tech is really going to get hammered for this because everybody, you know, lots of companies have embraced open office life, floor plans. And so we're not going to be able to do that anymore. And so the amount of money we're going to have to pay just to retrofit our existing space to fit less people in it is significant. And when you think about all the other things that you could be spending that money on that are actually going to have a higher impact to the business, you know, it's going to make it hard to justify going through all of that to get people back in office who probably many of them don't want to be there. Some people do. Some people are dying and they're like, get me back in the office immediately. But
I see a mix of parents that want to go back to the office very quickly and parents that are loving the time at home. There's a real divide there.
But I mean, the reality too, I mean, for parents, it's like if your schools aren't open, what are you going to do? Like you can't go back in an office and leave. I mean, maybe you can if your kids are older, but if you've got young kids, that's just not an option. So it's
one of the things that came out in another PwC report was the mega trends. And one of them is this global rapid urbanization, people moving back to cities. And like for you mentioned San Fran and like the property markets just skyrocketing. Yeah. You look at companies like Amazon that were opening sort of HQs in one in Washington, one in New York State, employing 50,000 people at each site. And the knock-on effect of each site, well, 25,000 at each site, the knock-on effect was that all these services, businesses, and that sort of thing was creating huge property demand. So I wonder whether this rapid urbanization is now going to actually sort of move back out and people actually go to choose where they live. And I was having this conversation with some friends the other night because we were looking at UK and property in the UK. And it was, well, are people now going to want to choose to live in the country or by the sea and not necessarily be on a commuter link? Because if your commuter link is now remote, what does it matter? Now, obviously there are jobs, but then we can get into this for hours, I'm sure, but you then sort of look at, well, what does that mean for retail within a city center? We're seeing an awful lot of bankruptcies and filings for retail clothing chains and that sort of thing. Is this going to mean the sort of the death of the mall type thing? And that's a whole other question I want to get to. And I don't believe that necessarily, because I think there's still an innate human nature that needs to be social, wants to be out and be and seen and socialize around that thing. And so when I talk about the Thanos snap, I do think you're going to see a point either when a vaccine comes out or when we're far enough along this trend that there's going to be another snap where kind of everything that was normal comes back to normal in a certain way, shape, or form. And everyone keeps talking about this new normal. And I hate that phrase because the new normal, every day it's a new normal at the moment, right? Yeah. Every day, nothing else that happens that we're going to go, okay, well, that's interesting.
I think that's right. Because I think a lot of times we talk about new normal, new normal, there's a connotation towards that, that it's set, right? Yeah. The new normal is that it's fluid and we're not going to know where we're going to end up until we get there. And that horizon is a year out, at least. So
imagine all the government things that you have to do that require paper and form filling in, right?
Yeah.
But now in the last 6 weeks, they've suddenly found a way to do it online.
Right.
The efficiencies of some of the stuff that we used to drive us crazy are going to be amazing because they've had to do it.
Yeah.
And so that's a good new normal. I'd rather go, look, that's a good positive efficiency we're seeing from this.
Telehealth, telemedicine. There's so many things that people have been wanting. There's been an appetite for, but we just didn't have the will to make it happen. And this has forced that. So I think that's a great point. And I want to we're coming up on time, but before we wrap up, I want to turn it over to you for just a closing bit that we use to end every show called One Good Thing. So I want you to share one good thing with the listeners, anything that comes to mind, and the floor is yours.
Okay. So I'll hopefully send you a picture of what it looks like if I open the windows and the door, because I am very fortunate to live on an island. And where I live is there's a kind of a row of our houses, and there's a canal that comes in off the sea, and there's some houses opposite us. And so when we were locked down into curfew at 7 o'clock every night, that was it, hard curfew. It was a bit like the blowing of the conch and everyone had to get inside. I said that, look, I want to do something every night at 7 o'clock. Now, all around the world, they do the clap for the frontline workers. And so it was like, great, we'll do a clap for the frontline workers, but then let's have a rooftop dance party and invite all the neighbors and let's just see where that goes. So we started that 6 weeks ago, and every night at 7 o'clock, we go out there and we play 30 minutes of tunes. And I'll play a song, and then somebody across the canal will play a song. And it now has become this community thing that every night at 7 o'clock, all the neighbors come out into the backyards or the roof terraces or what have you. And we just have this eclectic mix of music, and the power of bringing people together through music is just phenomenal. We've played, so in 6 weeks, we've done six nights a week for 6 weeks for 30 minutes. It's something like 18 hours worth of music, nearly 400 songs, and an average of 10 songs a night type thing. So that whole, it's one good thing about this whole COVID thing that it has made me, we didn't know half of our neighbors at this point. You know, you pass them just wave, but now we know what music they're like, we know how they dance, we know how many of them drink every night. It's brilliant. And I just think that it's brought out the little nice things in our community. And so that's definitely the one good thing for me that's come out of this whole experience. And we'll continue. We're going to do it every night until we get let off or let out. And then we're going to be partying together.
Yeah, that's well, now you've got lots of DJs in the neighborhood to call on. I've seen some videos on Instagram. They've been amazing. So the human spirit, this is not going to break us. It's going to test us. But it's not going to break us. So. Well, Chris, thanks so much for coming on, sharing your journey, sharing your experience, and sharing the dance party. We have to get a follow-up playlist from you. Green Island 7 p.m. dance party playlist. So
boom, done.
For the viewers, thanks for tuning in. We're gonna be back tomorrow, same time, noon Eastern, with my friend Ambrosia Bertesi. We're gonna talk about her new role over at Operator Collective, and we're gonna talk about how this whole thing is having a really rapid acceleration on the field of HR, the field of open source, which is founders of HR open source, is in our blood. So we're excited about that. And in the meantime, stay safe and be good. And we'll see you tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this episode of 21st Century HR. If you want to hear more episodes like this or read stories from the 21st Century HR Fast Company series, go to 21stcenturyhr.com. And if you want to make your podcast just a little more awesome, be sure to subscribe to the show on iTunes, Spotify, SoundCloud, or whatever podcast platform your ears desire. You'll find all the subscribe links on the website. And if you enjoy the podcast, do me a favor and share it with your peers, your network, your boss, and your CEO. Help me get the podcast into the ears of anyone who wants to know what HR and recruiting looks like when done really well. They'll thank you for it, and so will I. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next episode.